All right, so this is the fourth and final installment of The Christian's Guide to the Enlightenment. And this fourth semester, I'm going to be principally handling Kant. I was going to put at the beginning some of the political philosophy of the time. I'm probably going to do that now at week six. I'm going to put that at the end. Today's is going to be called a Kantian Revolution, and that's K-A-N-T, after Immanuel Kant, a Kantian revolution. Let me just do a little review of this chart, just so everybody remembers where we're at. First of all, the timeline, you see between 1600 and 1800. If you want to be super technical, what was the Enlightenment, or what was modern philosophy? Well, at the top of the stairs, to borrow Schaeffer's imagery, you could say 1637 to 1781. Just using the bookmarks of Descartes' Discourse and Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. That's where modern philosophy was born, and that's where modern philosophy died. There's problems with that approach, though. It's some of these things overlap. But that's, anyway, a good map. So you have Descartes here, starting rationalism. Locke here, starting empiricism. Hume, wanting to be an empiricist, but landing into skepticism. And certainly naturalism. And then Kant over here. And just as little markers, I have here's the Great Awakening here in the time of Hume, and here's the American Revolution going on when Kant is writing. So, just a little bit of a visual. And then this is a chart that we have for the kids in the academy, is this rationalism man and empiricism man, signified by two light bulbs, because the question was, I wanted to show the kids, what is enlightenment? What is the enlightenment? Well, this is a pictorial way to say it. Before this time, you had the light coming from up here in the medieval era. Now, after the Reformation, you had the man on the street confused. You had the dawn of rationalism. And the guy on the left, this is just a question about these numbers 1 and 2. It's just a question of where the light comes from. Now, they're signified by light bulbs because, of course, if you're in a house, the house of reason, and you want to block out the sun, revelation, well, then you're going to have to come up with some artificial light. So that's why I picked a light bulb. Rationalism, Descartes, that's why he's got the mustache and the French look to him. But you probably can't see that. Trust me on that one. But the light bulb, it's coming from inside of his mind. So you see rationalism, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. In other words, I think, therefore everything else. So the one is in his mind, and the two is that his hands are out of the world. On the right, you have empiricist man, and that's kind of John Locke. You have the one out here at the light bulb, which is in his hand. So that's where the light bulb's coming from. And then you have the assembly line coming into his head. And so number two is in the head. So through sensation and reflection. In other words, through experience, you then get ideas, simple to complex and so on. Well, then you have David Hume with that same basic layout, except he adds a second assembly line from the passions. And those impressions are what form ideas. And that collapsed. But that's just the visual for the two different warring schools of enlightenment when modernism was in its heyday. So when you get past Hume, you have a problem if you're an advocate of the enlightenment. In the world of science, we can speak of a Copernican revolution. And in fact, Kant used that phrase for himself, very self-congratulatory. I have pulled off a Copernican revolution. In philosophy, that was his term. So we could speak of a Copernican revolution. In astronomy, a Newtonian revolution. In cosmology as a whole, in physics, and a Darwinian revolution in pseudobiology. I don't want to call it biology. But in the world of philosophy, the fault line between the modern and the postmodern worldviews was struck by what has been called the Kantian revolution. Now, it's true that philosophy, beginning at the turn of the 19th century, began to follow two lines, one of them called continental philosophy and one of them called Anglo-American philosophy. So right after this, you start to get a divide between continental and Anglo-American philosophy. And no matter what anybody tells you, here's what that was about. Continental philosophy took the claims of Kant seriously and went with it. Anglo-American philosophy tried to ignore or get around Kant's distinctions and therefore still went with it. They were oblivious, and so they were carried off by that same tectonic plate. So, this was a Kantian revolution that marks the watershed of all Western philosophy after that. And of course, if you follow Schaeffer with the staircase, I don't even have another one, so let's do this. So you say, okay, there's a Kantian revolution in philosophy. Who cares? I don't have to worry about that. Yes, you are. You're on those stairs. Everybody is on those stairs unless they intentionally apply a jackhammer to it or a rock climbing thing or a parachute in somewhere else. Whatever metaphor you want to use, if you don't consciously try to knock off the king of the hill off those stairs, you're on those stairs. Which means if you disagree with Kant but you don't know why, you agree with Kant. If you agree with Kant, you agree with Kant. If you don't know who Kant is, you agree with Kant. Anyone who's ever taught you anything has taught you Kant. At least mixed in the poison into the drink. So, as I said, I was originally going to do this unit with the scene of political philosophy coming first. The thought of Blackstone and Adam Smith and Edmund Burke and guys like that. Leading up to the French Revolution and the American Revolution. I'm going to do that week six. I'm still going to get into that. But as I've been mulling over some reading of John Frame's Systematic Theology, I finally got a copy of it when we were at the Shepherd's Conference. And as I've been in conversation with seminary students in other places, both in Southern California there and in Minneapolis, I've seen fit to focus on where virtually all today's seminary thinking comes from, what I have elsewhere called Kantianity as opposed to Christianity. We're going to look at this in four different points. First of all, Kant's background in books. Secondly, Kant's basic dilemma. Third, Kant's basic solution. And then fourthly, Kant's ghost among us. So the background in books, and then his basic dilemma. So I'm going to talk about his developing mind, what he sees as the problem, where Hume left off, and then finally get to his solution, and then we'll look at how that affects us directly today, in the church especially. First of all, Kant's background and books. Immanuel Kant, his dates are 1724 to 1804. He was a Prussian philosopher, although, interestingly, the family name was originally with a C. His father was Scottish, and they moved to Prussia. I didn't even know that until I thought I knew all the different details of his life. I neglected that one. But anyway, they were originally Scottish in their background. But at any rate, when he goes there, there's a legend that he never leaves his hometown of Königsberg in Prussia. That would later become Kaliningrad in Russia. The idea and the legend was that he not only never left his hometown, he does teach at that university, studies there his whole life, but the idea is that he never left the town and that he would take these daily walks that were so precise and so meticulous in everything he did that people in the town would actually set their watches by his daily walks. Well, that's all a bunch of mythology. First of all, he does travel a little bit in the 1750s to Poland and Russia, but he does strike us as an enigma. Because the question is, how is someone so reclusive to the rest of the European scene? How could he become the most seminal philosopher since Plato and Aristotle? And yet most people seem oblivious to his influence. In a nutshell, it was Kant who marks the transition from the modern to the postmodern. And there again, that's confusing. Well, postmodernism didn't become a household word until two centuries after Kant wrote. So what do you mean by that? Well, that's what we're going to talk about in the next 5 weeks. When he was still a student, as he later described, he was a rationalist. He was a follower of a guy named Christian Wolff, who was kind of a bridge between Leibniz, who we covered, and Kant, a rationalist. But then, after college, he's a little bit older, he started to read David Hume's more skeptical works. And he said, quote, "I was awakened from my dogmatic slumbers." In other words, his rationalist dogmatism. What he would wind up with was a total agnosticism of traditional philosophy and traditional theology. And agnosticism is going to be a key word. We won't see all of how that's the case. You'll probably pick up on it today, but you'll really see it as we go on in the weeks to come. But what he tries to do is he tries to give us this rationalist-empiricist hybrid. He sees that these two answers are no answers at all, but they're really two parts of something that human beings and human reason really needs. And so he kind of tries to put them together at first. But what he really does in the process is he recasts philosophy and he gives it a new task, no longer to try to discover wisdom, to try to discover what is, but a critical, which is why so many of his books begin with the word critique. The critique, because philosophy, he actually calls the critique a new science of philosophy. And you see this even in the Anglo-American strand. I said there are two different strands. That one follows Kant. That one tries to get on without him. But they really never do, because the best Anglo-American philosophy, logical positivism and analytic philosophy, really tries to really say the same thing Kant was saying. It's negative. You can only, and you see that in modern theology too, even in the hermeneutics of humility, and the idea of you can only know what is not, you can't know what is. Well, Kant wrote some major works. There's a bunch of works he wrote, but these five really provide the framework of his ideas. The Critique of Pure Reason is the big one. That's 1781, and that's on the subject of metaphysics. The Critique of Practice, that people will tell you otherwise. They'll say it's epistemology, but that's another story. He's still telling you the way it is in the universe. The Critique of Practical Reason, 7 years later. The Critique of Judgment, 1790. So one is just on metaphysics, one is just on morals, and one is on what is what we would call aesthetics. Religion, Within the Limits of Reason Alone, written in 1793, just ponder that title for a second. Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone. So just a typical, what you would expect from an Enlightenment author. And then finally, The Metaphysics of Morals in 1797. That's where he gives you his famous categorical imperative, which is what Christian hedonism is actually opposed to. And we'll get to that in a future week, Kant's ethics. It's basically Stoicism. That's all it is. But we'll get to that. All right, well, there's a lot of other writings, of course, but it's particularly the one I want to focus on is the one that was written in 1781 called The Critique of Pure Reason. That is the one that set off the atomic bomb in the playground of philosophers. Everything had changed with that thesis, and it has never been changed back since then. The religious upbringing of Kant is also important to know. So let's move to that second picture just for a second. I have Kant's developing mind, 1740 to 1770, and I've got a Venn diagram with these three circles. If you want to know where Kant wound up, what made up his mind, it's really a complex of rationalism and pietism and what I'm going to call anti-skepticism. In other words, his reaction to Hume. He doesn't like where Hume left us. But let's look at that first circle. Pietism, the one on the right, actually on that chart, the religious upbringing of Kant. He grew up in a Lutheran pietistic home. Keep your eye on this. Whether it is a Reformed home or a Lutheran home or anything else, a fundamentalist home in the 20th century, where you see the church refusing to treat Christianity as an objective thing and a comprehensive thing, guess what happens to your more reflective children? They rebel. Their minds just are going to leap up to some other flame if you don't give it to them. Okay? And there's the great, as Calvin called them, monster minds in the modern West have emerged from outside of the church. They have emerged from households that were essentially fundamentalist in their, or in this case, Lutheran pietist. By the beginning of the 18th century, pietism was more fully developed into a religious subjectivism. God, salvation, religious observance, and personal piety had all been moved entirely indoors so that the subjective, how I think, how I feel, what I can do with this, the subjective was religiously virtuous and the objective was cast under suspicion, divisive, arrogant, and so forth. The subjective was king in pietism. Well, besides the system itself, the Kant household was very strict in their religious observance, and the study of it was set in tension with things like math and science and logic, so that the young mind of Immanuel Kant was stifled. In 1740, he entered the University of Königsberg at age 16, The German rationalism of Leibniz and Christian Wolff was indoctrinated into Kant from his immediate teacher, Martin Knudsen, who at least had the good sense to expose his students to the empirical side of things and to Newton's system. And due to Kant's increasing interest in science, he actually contributed to its development when he won the Berlin Academy Prize in 1754 for a speculation concerning astronomy and the theory of energy. 100 years later, Lord Kelvin later summarized Kant's observation by saying, quote, that he discovered that the frictional resistance against tidal currents on the Earth's surface must cause a diminution of the Earth's rotational speed. So it's interesting. Kant actually did. Now, Kant also theorized some things that turned out to be a flop scientifically. But at any rate, he was, a lot of people don't know this, but he was very involved and interested in science. In 1770, Kant was made a professor of logic and metaphysics at that university. And he would write his own textbook on logic in 1800, in which we see his philosophy being pressed into the terms. It's interesting, I've looked through his logic as I've been developing my own logic notes. I kind of put him into the mix, and I use his, like, for example, when you talk about the three different kinds of statements, hypothetical, categorical, and disjunctive, he calls them judgments. That's a Kant word, but it means the same thing, and others have said the same. But what is he's doing? He's actually inserting his philosophy into logic. That's a lesson, because logic textbooks, I don't care how textbooky they look, they have a worldview contained in them. They are mere mortals pushing their worldview, so always remember that. But he writes his own textbook on logic, and once he takes the position that he does, he moves into what biographers and historians of philosophy refer to as the Silent Decade. And that is the time from 1771-ish to about 1781. He doesn't write anything for 11 years. So that's why I have his developing mind over there, and then blank, and then 1781 is the publication of the Critique of Pure Reason. What was he doing during that time? Well, he'd already confessed to grappling with Hume and being very much bothered by that skeptical dead end, that we can't really know the power behind cause and stuff like that. But he went the next 11 years without publishing anything because of it. He was sketching out his system by which reason could overcome its own death. Kant knew that Hume had plunged in the dagger, not the dagger into Christianity, which was true too in his mind, but he had plunged the dagger into reason itself, into the arguments against Christianity. And so he was sketching that out. But he also knew that the man on the street who was intoxicated by the Enlightenment's promises would not understand what Hume had done and would not even get the dark news in this generation. Only generations later would they find out. He alone could save reason. That's what all intellectuals think, by the way. I alone can reform society and publish these particular things and so on. But Kant would have to do so by coming to terms with the death of old objective reason. So that's the backdrop. He's going to save reason, but it is a foregone conclusion to him that objective reason, the essence of things, is dead. Hume's right. So we could say that the finished mind of Kant was a complex of those three things: pietism, rationalism, and anti-skepticism. Pietism from his Lutheran upbringing, rationalism from his studying the philosophy of Christian Wolff under that guy Knudsen at the University of Königsberg, and anti-skepticism from him reading Hume, getting full well what Hume got to, and saying, well then, not only can you not have the gospel in its traditional sense, which I don't care about, but you can't have science and ethics, which I do care about. Now, his technical epistemology, when he gets started, is sort of a rationalist-empiricist hybrid. Let's bring them together. But he's classified as a subjectivist for a very understandable reason. It was not simply about his motive to protect a faint spirituality and ethical action. It was that even the principles of the mind and even the data concerning the external world could only be talked about from the vantage point of one's own perception. So he's a subjectivist. He's going to shift the focus from the thing out there, the real world, to my perception of reality. Think of even the psychology of Carl Rogers and those who say reality is perception. Where do they get that? You get it from Kant. So here's the formula. If Hume began the inward revolt of the Enlightenment against itself by doubting our confidence in our reasoning about the world outside, Kant began rebuilding the new world of reason within. Kant did not seek to rebuild the old world of reason against Hume. He agreed with Hume that that was dead. He sought to rebuild a new world of reason on the inside. So think of every time you lead a Bible study and somebody says, what does this mean to you? In Kantian terms, that's pretty, good philosophy. The triumph of the sovereign subject occurs in Kant's critique. Having said that, though, it is technically more accurate to label Kant a transcendental idealist. But the problem is we haven't gotten there yet, so that's kind of a highfalutin word. But you'll see why that would be the most accurate thing to call his philosophy. So if you want to say, okay, Descartes' a rationalist, Locke, what's he? Okay, he's an empiricist. Hume's all messed up because he wants to be an empiricist, but he winds up a skeptic, and of course he's a naturalist. What's Kant? Well, Kant would be a transcendental idealist. What do you think of? You think of transcendental meditation, maybe? Well, we'll get to that. We'll explain how he uses that word. That word really is a Kantian word in its original. But Kant is a revolutionary in one sense. But in another, he stands in a general stream of those non-Christian lightweights who have tried to have it both ways. He requires the very stuff of metaphysics in order to write anything of objective meaning. In other words, he needs to, in order to say this is the way the world is, he needs to know the way the world is. He needs a world. He needs an intelligible world. He needs a world that stands outside of all of us, that all of us can actually look at the same thing and talk about. He needs that. But he places metaphysical claims, all of them, on a scale of irrelevant standards. And here's how he says it. He says that metaphysics, quote, must unquestionably be looked upon as a given, as presupposed. In other words, metaphysics must be considered as really existing. If not as a science, nevertheless as a natural disposition of the human mind. End quote. And yet, he gives the old standard line that no one system yet brought forward has ever made good on its claims. Hegel says pretty much the same thing. You start to get that from the Germans. No one person or system or group of people, before we came around, has ever thought about this. Yeah. A very sweeping statement that has been repeated ever since. All right, well, let's get to the meat of this stuff. Kant's basic dilemma and his solution. What was his basic dilemma? Well, as Hume left things off, no statement could have objective meaning unless it were either purely analytical or purely of empirical data. As Kant inferred from his reading of Hume, rationalism and empiricism had only succeeded in showing the insufficiency of the whole project of Western philosophy. To his mind, it had not yet occurred to anyone to make a finer distinction between what he would call analytical and synthetical statements. Get used to Kant making up words. Or at least giving us German words that have no English equivalent and seeming to like it. But these are real words. You just have to... Analytical and synthetical. And once I explain them, give a couple examples, you'll get the idea pretty quickly. Both are logical kinds of statements, but the one, as the name suggests, merely analyzes the terms. In other words, the predicate is contained in the subject. If the subject is, then so is the predicate. It's like unpacking the drawer from the same dresser. Now, the reason that this looms so large can be seen by recalling that last line of Hume's inquiry. Remember where he said that if it's a meaningful statement, it has to be either purely analytical or purely empirical. Well, the principle fell by its own weight because that statement is neither purely analytical or purely empirical. And yet both pathways to knowledge must really yield knowledge. Kant is looking at this and saying, yeah, but we do have science, and we do have ethics, and we do have meaningful statements. Surely Hume meant that statement to be a meaningful statement. If we don't, we have irreversible skepticism. So we've got to do something about this. But rationalism and empiricism both fell to the floor of the Enlightenment. What was needed was a rational empiricism. And so he begins his main work, I'll come back to those in just a second, he begins his main work, The Critique of Pure Reason, by saying, quote, and this is a key statement, it's a famous statement by Kant. He's going to deal with empirical stuff and logical stuff, and here's how he does it. Because remember, there's a separation there, there's a divorce. They're both not relating to each other anymore. So he says, quote, though our knowledge begins with experience. So I agree with Locke, I agree with Hume just that far. Yes, ideas come in through sensory experience. Though our knowledge begins with experience, it by no means follows that all arises out of experience. For on the contrary, it is quite possible that our empirical knowledge is a compound of that which we receive through impressions and that which the faculty of cognition supplies of itself. Sensuous impressions giving only the occasion. So what is he saying? He's saying, of course, all the stuff of our thinking comes into us from the external world, but that would make no sense unless there was a grid or a superstructure or handles or grabbers or, I'm just really using really simplified imagery here, to make sense of those things, a thinking thing. And not like Descartes, just a bald, bare thinking thing. I mean, categories of the mind in some way. Now, ideas or necessary concepts do not correspond to any object in the sensory world. That's going to create a problem for him. So he's still kind of accepting the Enlightenment idea of that. This fundamental problem of empiricism, Kant thought, cut equally against idealism. So if you're wondering, not only did Kant think of rationalism and empiricism as incomplete insufficient, but also Berkeley's response to Locke in idealism. There's no indication that Kant, of course, ever read anything like Jonathan Edwards, but at any rate, probably read Berkeley. And idealism was insufficient too. Because ideas or necessary concepts don't correspond to anything in the sensory world. So he's trying to put all this together. Now, since Kant accepts the skeptical assault on metaphysics, he agrees with Hume. There is no more certainty in our knowledge of objects. There's the upshot of what he gets from Hume. There is no more certainty, never was really, there is no certainty in our knowledge of objects as they are. So what, God, future life? Yes, and that piece of chalk. If you're consistent, you can't know what the thing in itself is. And we'll get to what he means by the thing in itself probably starting next week. But there is no certainty in our knowledge of objects. Metaphysical objects, physical objects, because physical objects are ultimately metaphysical objects. The two don't correspond. There's no connection yet between our reason and the stuff out there. Now, this is no strike against religion in his mind, because his pietistic upbringing had already taught him to think of it entirely in subjective terminology. On the other hand, science and ethics still require an objective lingo. By the way, don't distract yourself as we study Kant. The question of whether or not Kant was an atheist in the closet or an agnostic or a Christian who was pietistic as a Christian and it led to agnosticism or a hybrid of the... It ultimately doesn't matter. In fact, it would do you well to consider him a Christian because one of the things you want to do is not simply lob bombs at the culture but to say to yourself, well, how can a Christian go wrong here? We want to not go wrong here. So it really doesn't matter what Kant's actual faith really was. Here's what matters. He's a man of the Enlightenment. Science and ethics were the twin pillars of the secular society that was envisioned by the Enlightenment. We might not need to have a personal relationship with God in the traditional sense as classical Christianity conceived. But we certainly do need to know and to control our world. That's science. And we need to not kill each other in the process. That's ethics. What ultimately reality is, we cannot know that. We cannot know the essence of things. Hume has to be right about that. But what we experience and what we do, in order to do that, we're going to have to assume. We're going to have to presuppose the reality of ultimate things to get on with practical things. I can't know who God is or what God is. I certainly can't prove God to you. But in order to do ethics and act morally in society, I have to assume God exists. I have to assume there's a future judgment. I have to assume that He's ordering the world in some way. Okay? I can't show you God, but I can show you a rock, but there's no connection because this failed. So I'm going to assume God exists for science too. In order to do any of these things, I'm going to presuppose the reality of God. So Kant begins to conceive of a divide between the theoretical and the practical. So as we move on to Kant's basic solution, notice that line. It is the line that has been with us since Plato and Aristotle. It's that dividing line, as Plato called it, but we've been using it as a line in history, and Francis Schaeffer eventually uses this horizontal line as what he calls the line of despair. And it starts sinking and sinking and sinking further and further below the line. And so this line is not simply a historical timeline. This line is a line, traditionally, in the medieval world, between things above, things below. Things of heaven, things of earth. Things of eternity, things of time. Things invisible and things visible. And you get the idea. You can substitute any number of words in there. Well, Kant draws up that same line. And here's how he pictures everything. And that's why when people say, well, Kant gives us what the Enlightenment already had, namely an epistemology, not a metaphysic. Well, come on. If it's an epistemology, regardless of how much you disagree with the medieval people, it is a metaphysic. You are telling us the way the world is. The most deluded, pot-smoking postmodern person in the world believes that what he's saying is the way the world is. He says, well, your truth is your truth, my truth is my truth, whatever floats your boat. So are you saying that it's true that whatever floats your boat? Is that the case? Well, there's no meta-narrative. There's no one way the world is. Where is there no way the one way the world is? In one world or in no world or in two worlds? Or in, okay, so it's a metaphysic. He is giving us his way of the world is. So this is not simply an epistemology. What does Kant do? He draws a horizontal line. And the name of the two realms are the first word you have to get. The noumenal is the realm above the line, and the phenomenal is the realm below the line. And what that basically means, noumen, of course, noumen with a P is the Greek word for spirit. And phenomenal is from the Greek word for appearances. So basically what it comes to mean is this. The noumenal realm is the realm of the real. In other words, he is at least going to agree with Plato and traditional Western thought on one thing, just on the label. I don't think we can know it. But the real world, namely the way things are in themselves, outside of our minds, that's the real world, the noumenal. And we can't know that. And that inability to know that is what he calls pure reason. By reason, knowing this, that's pure reason. Now down here is the phenomenal, that's the world of appearances. And he calls that kind of thinking practical reason. One of the ironies right away is that we can't know the real world, and so because we have to get on with the real world, right away, now, when you're 200 years later, you don't even notice that that's what you're saying at the foundation, because you're not at the foundation anymore. You're like at the 34th floor, because it's 200 years later. Okay? But this is the real world, and we can't know that. But in order to do science and ethics, we simply have to assume, we simply have to presuppose. You and I cannot look at the same object. That's objects. That's outside of us. And so above the line, I have objective essence of things. Below, I have subjective experience of things. We can't know the way the world is. We cannot, with each other, talk about something that both of us can look at outside of ourselves. Anything outside of ourselves, science, ethics, or religion. That's pure reason, and we can't know the way that things are in themselves. But since we have to live, We must presuppose, presuppositions, start our subjective thinking, and everything after the presupposition is by definition subjective thinking, which is a denial of their objective reality. Kant's basic solution is that chart. And out of that chart is going to come the theory versus practice divide. In 19th century liberal theology, the orthodoxy versus orthopraxy divide, the eternal Christ versus the human Jesus divide. You name it, it comes from that. You name it, in any field, any realm, any bad thought comes from that, comes out of that. You say, aren't there bad thoughts before Kant? Yes, and they flowed through his grid. He is like the dam, and it all comes through him, through his reservoir, through his filter. Well, we'll see how he gets there, and we'll see all that this implies for everything else. For now, let's just make some introductory observations that will put some flesh on Kant's solution and his influence. Once this Kantian divide became accepted, so right at the turn of the 19th century, it was impossible after that. In fact, it was unthinkable for any realm of theoretical thought to return to any talk about things without total reference to the subject's internal experience or practical usefulness. Thus, every other philosophy after Kant is still bowing to Kant, inside Kant, flowing from Kant's mind, Kant being inside their mind. The divide divides all, theory and practice. And once the world accepts this, then no practice is safe, because practice thinks. And that means that the practical man and his practice have also accepted this divide and built a fortress of the self around whatever practice is deemed necessary or expedient or mature or morally serious. This is not just a liberal thing, it's a conservative thing. It affects everyone and everything. Theory can no longer speak to practice. Oh, such a liberal thing. Theory can no longer speak to practice. Get your blue state theory, mumbo jumbo, Freudian stuff out of my face and be morally serious. Theory can no longer speak to practice, which is to say, practice is both the most real thing and unaccountable to what is the real essence of things at the same time and in the same relationship. But see, that's just the law of non-contradiction, which is an object outside of us. We don't have access to that. So don't worry about that. It becomes very clear how nihilism and pragmatism and phenomenology and existentialism and then finally fully developed postmodernism all flow from the stream of Kant's divide. Indeed, they are all merely different dimensions of Kant's divide, each depending on the preferences and the proclivities of that particular philosopher. But, as we've said about other things in the past, we are all Kantians now. We are all Kantians now, unless you intend on rising above it. It should also be pointed out that the original publication of the Critique was a complete flop. It was an enormous book, it was exceedingly German, and it was written like an owner's manual to a nerd's convention, which one already has to be nerdy enough to own. So it didn't really make much of a splash. 2 years later, though, Kant wrote a Prolegomena to any future metaphysics, that's 1783. Basically, it's a Cliff Notes. It's to boil down, for those a little bit further down the stairs, the thesis of the Critique. And a year later, his friend and colleague, Johann Friedrich Schulz, wrote a commentary on the original work to further argue for its significance. Three other more agreeable works by Kant completed the toppling of the dominoes. He wrote an essay, The Answer to the Question, What is Enlightenment?, which vaulted him into a little bit more prominence. The Groundwork of the Metaphysic of Morals in 1785, and The Metaphysical Foundations of Natural Science in 1786. And so then there was this other dispute that went on between some other big-time thinkers of the day, and somebody suggested that, well, you really should listen to Kant about this. And that vaulted him into fame, and so people started to read it by the time you hit about 1800. If the Critique was Kant's womb, then there were twins that came from it, one in philosophy and the other in religion. German idealism, through two thinkers you haven't heard of maybe, but then you got Hegel, Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel, That philosophy was the philosophical twin. German idealism came out of Kant, although he disagreed with them in how they were interpreting him. Before he died, of course, he didn't read Hegel's work necessarily, but the earliest writers, he immediately disagreed with them. And then the other twin, liberal theology of Friedrich Schleiermacher, along with higher criticism in Germany, was the religious twin. But it was really the Enlightenment that Kant cared about. Not that he wasn't religious in his own way, but it was really the Enlightenment that he cared about. He desired to save the Enlightenment by curbing and correcting the environment? The Enlightenment. He said, quote, and here again, it's the same thing, same motive and flavor that you get from all of Kant's statements. He says, if one cannot prove that a thing is, which, by the way, I would argue that that's presupposed. What you should have done with that last line of Hume is what better Christian apologists have done since then, which is to show why it's self-contradictory. And I don't have to bow the knee to something that's self-contradictory. Once it doesn't make good on its claims, I can happily go on to the metaphysics of the medieval world that was carrying on the Christian tradition. Just because a bunch of people show up and they have bigger, stronger tasers and tanks than you do, and they can count more heads and break more noses, doesn't follow that what they're saying is true. And therefore, I happily go on with sanity while the rest of the world goes to insanity. But Kant didn't do that. He said, if one cannot prove that a thing is, he may try to prove that it is not. If he fails to do neither, as often occurs, he may still ask whether it is in his interest to accept one or the other of the alternatives hypothetically. Now, let's stop right there. That brings us to a section at the end of his critique called the antinomies. What he does is he shows four different ways, areas of natural theology, the traditional arguments for God's existence, that could be argued both ways. In other words, you could prove, in quotes, both sides of the argument. So he calls them antinomies. So he's saying, well, since we can't resolve that, the thing to do is to ask practically, which is in my interest to presuppose? I will presuppose that one and get on with my life. Who believes this now? The Reformed community today. I'll come back to that. He continues. From the theoretical or the practical point of view, hence the question no longer is as to whether perpetual peace is a real thing or not a real thing, or as to whether we may not be deceiving ourselves when we adopt the former alternative, but we must act on the supposition of its being real. End quote. It should be pointed out that Kant at least did pay lip service to the cause of religion. But notice how he did so. He said later on in life that he made faith safe from the probing lens of reason. The things of faith are now entirely above the line. You can't touch them. Can't prove them. Can't talk about them to others as if they have a claim on them, but you can't criticize them either. You're rationally justified in believing them because your presupposition is as good as another person's presupposition. Kant's ghost among us. Why does Kant matter today? Besides my claim that he's the flow of everything else after that in a continuous manner, but can I show him show up concretely today? Yes. In a nutshell, the whole, for the most part, I know people don't like when I make type A statements when I obviously don't really literally mean all swans are white, but nevertheless, most, to such a degree that it's worth saying, red alert, red alert, red alert, we're going, this is what we're told is Reformed theology the only acceptable alternative. So most of the Reformed world today is almost entirely captured by the post-Kantian epistemology called perspectivalism. I partially lied about this. Next week we'll get into this specifically. I forget. I did the notes for both weeks together, and so I remember that I had it. So I will get to the analytical and synthetic technically next week. But let me introduce this word to you. Let me spell it right first. Perspectivalism. Yeah, perspectivalism. Who are you? I'm a perspectivalist. Perspective. Now, if you would have asked me 10, 15 years ago, if someone is going to church or teaching at seminary and they're a perspectivalist, and then you just give me a cursory understanding of what it means, I would say, okay, so a liberal, okay, I get it. Oh man, we're in trouble. It made its final conquest over the Reformed world in the past two generations with the success of the apologetic school known as presuppositionalism. We can draw a straight line from continental philosophy in the 19th century through the Dutch thinkers at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. Now, Kuyper and Bavinck did a good job of communicating what is essentially a realist classical Christianity. However, and Bavinck even criticized the post-Kantian theologians as being ethical theologians. They understood so much of what was wrong with the post-Kantian universe, but they still used the language in many respects. And the early 20th century Dutch theologians were particularly to blame for this. Herman Dooyeweerd and others who brought this idea forward of Kant. Well, Van Til studied in that atmosphere. Cornelius Van Til, his dates are 1895 to 1987, and Gordon Clark, whose dates are 1902 to 1985, Van Til and Clark became the warring factions of who would get to define what this thing called presuppositionalism, as the name became, would be. But you can draw a straight line from Kant directly to them. Now, Clark was a hybrid objectivist perspectivalist. When he speaks at times like the classical Christians think, treating logic that way. His textbook on logic is very good. He takes the right position against Van Til on the particular issue of, does our knowledge of things in any way function as an analogy of God's knowledge of things? Van Til takes the total skeptical position, which I'm sure they wouldn't like me calling skeptical. But that's another story. But since the days when they famously debated, Van Til's disciples have won the public relations battle in Reformed seminaries. For a few decades, it looked as if Clark had scored the victory through people like his disciple Carl F.H. Henry and the wider neo-evangelical movement under Billy Graham, in which Henry operated as kind of the floating theologian and brain of the movement. Popular apologetics rose together with evangelical political engagement. But that was then. With the collapse of the evangelical cultural consensus, which I'm not a fan of, I'm not defending it, and the subsequent rise of the new Calvinism, the Van Tilians have pounced with all their might upon the lightweight philosophical musings of the Gospel Coalition, Crossway Publishing, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Reformed Theological Seminary, both Westminster Seminaries. John Frame and Vern Poitras have written prodigiously and imaginatively to package Van Til's system in a way that absolves the new Calvinist mind of the responsibility of taking every thought captive in the comprehensive way that this would have been understood in classical Christianity. The fully developed epistemology is dubbed by Frame tri-perspectivalism, adding to it the wonder of the stamp of the Trinity. And no doubt, in terms of second-order epistemology, and I'm going to make a distinction in the course of these 6 weeks about first-order epistemology, which is what it really is. What's my standard? How do I know that I know? What's truth criterion? What is knowledge outside of my mind? As a second-order epistemology, a lot of what Frame does is actually quite useful, biblical, helpful. There's much to commend to the idea. But we will see how it walks in lockstep with the post-Kantian flow of thought in each subsequent session. For now, let me just show how it came to be smuggled in through the Trojan horse of presuppositional apologetics. So just 5 minutes on how this happened on a pop level. There was an initial straw man that was set up on the field of battle, which then set up a corresponding either-or dilemma. So here's how it happened. Because, of course, Christians in a post-Christian university context are not going to have their views changed necessarily in the university. So I'm going to show you three sets of straw men in order and the either-or dilemma that followed from it. There was an initial one, and then two other ones followed, and I'll put those down here. The initial straw man was what I call classicalism equals evidentialism.
If you're a classicalist, you're an evidentialist. So the straw man is set up on the field of battle. Oh. Evidentialist. Or, so that V is or you're a presuppositionalist. I'll just abbreviate presupp. So out of that straw man, classical equals evidentialist versus presuppositionalist, what does that do? That says you only have two options. If you're not a classicalist, by which I mean an evidentialist. So if you're a Reformed classicalist, you agree with Lee Strobel. And you're okay with him putting in his books people that settle the problem of evil with the free will defense. In other words, you're one of those people that says, let's just say for the sake of argument, and you pretend that the unbeliever has a point, or you start to mold your apologetics, just like you do in an Arminian church in your evangelism, you mold it to what he's seeking. If you're a classicalist, you're an evidentialist, and if you're an evidentialist, you are in that tradition. So there's a little bit going on here. These straw men give us either-or dilemmas. Sorry, let me put the other either-or dilemmas up there first, and then I'll just tell you the story. But the first Trojan horse of this apologetic method, this is happening between 1950 and the year 2000. When that happens, now you're in the present situation in which two more straw men appear on the field out of that straw man. Realism equals Platonism. So if I'm a realist, I'm a Platonist. And we don't have time right now to go into what all that means. But that is set up against voluntarism. Now, that is already a comparing of apples and oranges. But you see this in comparing natural law. These things are the way they are because that's the way it is. This is an actual real thing. Four-legged cats are real things. Natural law is not violated because there's a three-legged cat. We've gone into that before with Aquinas. Now, when I say Platonist, you can also be accused of being an Aristotelian. Point is, you're a classicalist. Now, that is opposed, we are told, to the idea that, no, things are the way they are because God wills them to be so. And so William of Ockham and others at the end of the Middle Ages made this mistake about naturalism. And who sucked it up? Luther and some of the early reformers. Who now sucks it up? Everybody I just mentioned in the Reform world. And so, for example, you have the book by Greg Thornberry on recovering classical evangelicalism that buys into this radical just juxtaposition between voluntarism and natural law, which is just a wing of realism. Well, you're comparing apples and oranges. We've already resolved that in prior classes, that God wills things to be so and that those things have an objective nature corresponding to his nature are not contradictory. But you have that straw man, which then sets up that either-or dilemma. Last straw man that sets up an either-or dilemma is objectivism equals verificationism or perspectivalism. Objectivism equals verificationism, which when you first learn what perspectivalism is, you learn that it is opposed to, ism, versus perspectivalism. Now, here's where those two differ. They are epistemologies. One says, this is the traditional, it follows the traditional Western view of truth. Truth is what the real world, my mind, corresponds to the real world. How do you know? Well, there's certain standards for verifying whether the objects in my mind called ideas correspond to the objects in the real world. I verify them. That's why there's rulers. I verify them by counting. That's verificationism. That's the old way of thinking. But we now know, I love it when people talk like that. We now know that everybody just has their own perspective. Okay. So, Trojan horse, 1950 to 2000. The Trojan horse of classicalism equals evidentialism, or your choice is presuppositionalism. Out of that Trojan horse, from the year 2000 on in the New Calvinism, you have these two that have popped out of the Trojan horse. Well, what's the problem? Well, academically first. Classical epistemology, which was always part of metaphysics. In other words, knowledge is an object outside of my mind before my mind conforms to it. Classical epistemology is not identical to evidential apologetics.
The classical apologists of the first few centuries and the modern era all made use of wide evidence, or wide use of evidence. That's true. They both did. Justin Martyr and Lee Strobel both used evidence. But we're comparing apples and oranges here. Augustine, Anselm, Thomas Aquinas, John Calvin, Jonathan Edwards all saw the use of positive proof and evidence to be of value. But they did not have the same assumptions about human reason as the and human seeking as the tradition that followed Jacob Arminius and Hugo Grotius, which empties out in the kind of pop apologetics in the contemporary seeker church. In fact, we are mixing apples and oranges and bananas, because not only is the adjective classical being used indiscriminately of a metaphysic at one point and an apologetic method at another, but there's also no critical allowance for what differences in soteriology, a third thing, might be driving the method among those that we sometimes label classicalist and evidentialist. So there are really three distinct reference being slapped with the same label. A few generations of Reformed seminary students became convinced that they needed to choose between an Arminian evidentialism by the name classicalism and a Reformed presuppositionalism. Nothing else was allowed. In between the two generations, another debate was held, somewhat less celebrated than the Clark-Van Til debate, and that was the debate between Greg Bahnsen and R.C. Sproul. And this debate was equally unhelpful in that the presuppositionalist cited Aristotle to defend philosophical certainty, that should be our argument, and the classicalist defended St. Thomas, but bristled at the objective kind of certainty. And that only muddied up the waters even more, right at that foundational issue. Now, to his credit, Sproul opened off the debate by listing a concern that presuppositionalism was essentially a repackaged neo-orthodoxy. And no doubt, whenever Sproul says that, and whenever I say things like that, I know people that are presuppositionalists, I get the response, no. Van Til wrote a book against the Barthians. No. Clark wrote a book against this. And no, they're against Kant. Yeah, I'm sure they want to be against Kant. I'm sure they obviously don't understand the sense in which what Barth was saying is identical to what Kant was saying, which are both identical to what you're saying. Let me give you one concrete link between Kant and Barth, and that is in the area of religious motive. Namely, to remove the objects of faith from the criticisms of modernity. We want to remove the objects of faith from the probing lens of the scholar, from the critic. Well, Kant drew up the initial line, and Barth followed with his divorcing natural theology from the sovereign redemption of God, from divorcing the Word of God, capital W, from the words of God, lowercase w. Separating the resurrection from the realm of verifiable history. So, well, the resurrection really happened, but in a realm called meta-history. They can't touch that. Well, that's just wonderful, but the Bible says it happened in totally history. In 1 Corinthians, that's the massage version, 1 Corinthians 15. But paradoxically, when the new inerrantists who follow Frame make the words of God through human authors, which we agree that those are the words of God against Barth, we agree with that. When they make those words of God stand as the primary objects apart from their ontological reference. Let me explain what that means. There's another author who does it, not just Frame, and that is John Salehammer in a book, big book, called The Meaning of the Pentateuch, in which he criticized the medieval method and particularly Augustine in Augustine's book on Christian doctrine. Augustine had a preference for what he called the res against the signa, the things over the signs. Now, the signs were the words of the scriptures. Those signs meant things. You know, so when Moses in Genesis talks about the tree, that was a real tree. When Galatians 3:13 talks about the tree, cursed is everyone who hung on a tree, that's a real tree. And the nature of trees outside of the scripture are what they are, and that's why the scripture's talking about them. That doesn't mean that we are letting the Bible be dominated by extra-biblical trees. Okay? So Salehammer is criticizing Augustine because he sees in him this proclivity to move beyond the scriptures, to graduate to real things for the smarty people and leave behind the words of God. You don't need to do that to oppose Barth. When this movement makes the words of God through human authors stand as the primary objects, apart from their ontological reference, they are actually agreeing with Barth against or about Kant's divorce, even while they are attempting to oppose Barth in their bibliology. And the fact that almost nobody can see this is one of the great challenges for a new generation of seminary students who I hope will reclaim objective Christianity back from its post-Kantian tomb. Let me close there and open it up to questions or comments.
Mm-hmm. We take them out of the, you know, microscope of modernity, right?
Yeah.
We remove them that way. No one can touch them.
Yeah.
Why? They're afraid to point out that they're false, so you don't really believe.
Yes.
And I was trying to figure out what Paul says, I know and am convinced of whom I have believed.
Yep.
That's not, no, don't scrutinize what I'm telling you.
Mm-hmm.
Don't scrutinize, don't be skeptical of the things I'm telling you. He's saying, go ahead, look at it.
Right.
I'll tell you everything you want to know.
Right.
If you want to know.
Yep.
I'm not afraid of God being false.
Yeah.
And if you are, then you'll try and hide it and say, oh, that's faith. You can't touch that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everyone has their faith.
Yeah.
Okay, but what's your faith based on?
And you'll do that in other areas of your theology, too. We think we're being hardcore when we do that. Remember that video by Psy 10?
Yeah.
That presuppositionalist video. Oh, I'm not going to let them determine, like, you're the one beating your chest and drawing these lines. You're not. You're afraid and you're retreating.
Yeah, and then what's the, I would say, what is the purpose or goal of what you're doing? Is it to shed the light of God through the gospel of Christ onto the darkness of this world, mm-hmm. that some men may be called forth out of it, or is it to win an argument?
Right.
Oh, I'll shut you up with my stronger presuppositionalism.
Yeah.
Presuppositionalism, yeah, you can point out the fallacies of people's presuppositions.
Right.
But if that's your only goal, then it's actually no different than their hatred of God.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. It's
right.
The same species.
Yeah.
So it's like, are you trying to elevate people out of the muck and mire, or are you just trying to push them down in it?
Didn't you see that effect in when he was with that in that video? When he was at that guy's house after the video, and he kept going on that same line, and he couldn't say anything other. And it reminded me of all the kids in school that ever said, "I know you are, but what am I?"
Yeah.
It was just like, really? Is that? That's faithfulness. Now, at that point, I know some presuppositionalists would argue and say, come on, you're taking, you know, we could pick somebody on your side. That now, that's fair enough. I don't want to lump all presuppositionalists into that, with how that guy performed. But at the end of the day, the motive is the same. You mentioned it, fear. Presuppositionalism is nothing but Dutch highbrow fundamentalism. It's the same motive. It's the same end. It's the same structure. It does the same things. But it does so with slightly more Dutch names, bigger books, and they got control over the seminaries. They won. They won the PR war. But it is highbrow Dutch fundamentalism, and it will erode the Christian faith.
Well,
it will.
That Psy 10 video, I mean, that point where he just keeps, you know, kicking that dead horse. It's like, look, the guy is, you know, already admitting, okay, yeah, there's a dead horse here. Mm-hmm. I can't fully see it, but you keep kicking it.
Yeah.
It's not neighing or whinnying, so obviously it's dead. That was his open door to preach the gospel to him.
Right.
But he doesn't.
Right.
It's kind of like, oh, you're on that team, now you're what? You're in the leper colony or something. There's like, where's the grace in this?
Right. And it's not the way the biblical, it's not the way Jesus argued, it's not the way the apostles argued. Jesus and the apostles argued within the cultural context that these people were in, and they used all manner of arguments. It's just not true. It is simply not biblical, nor is it Reformed, if you go back in the history of Reformed theology. So, in all those ways, and so it comes from Kant. And so that's why when we go through Kant in detail in the next 4 weeks, we'll start to see all the connections, and we'll see it beyond just the realm of apologetics. We'll see it in the philosophy of ministry.